Hello, everyone. Welcome to another Bounty episode of the Day Zero podcast. I'm Spectre, with me is Z. Today we have a GitLab account takeover, a Sonic Wall Apache O-Day, and an unauthed RCE and Adobe Cold Fusion. We'll kick it off with the Sonic Wall Critical Apache O-Day. So this is a vulnerability in Apache OF Biz, which they state is an open source enterprise resource planning system, and is apparently used in things such as Jira. So I'll let Z get into this one.
Yeah, so this one's kind of just a fun little bug that I saw. Like, I saw the proof of concept for this one, and, like, you know, that's fun. That could be fun to talk about. Turns out it's actually a little bit older, too, because there is a little bit of history with this bug. They call this out here, that Sonic Wall Capture Labs threat research team discovered this authentication bypass vulnerability. They gave it the CV and all of that. And while looking at the root cause of a separate vulnerability, is how they kind of found this. The POC is this require password change equals Y. And that is basically a magic string that lets you bypass all the authentication checks just by including that. But this was tracked as a pre-auth RCE in Apache OF Biz because there was a deserialization feature that, if you take a look at the security measure that was taken, it's literally just, let's just remove this control XML RPC and kind of the endpoint right there. If the body contains serialized, like, they're just removing this code that did this insecure deserialization. That was their fix, ignoring the auth bypass aspect of this, where to hit that point and being pre-auth was because of the inclusion of the string there. So they just removed it here, thinking that that would fix everything. And, you know, if we just get rid of the XML RPC, there's nothing you can do. Turns out it is just generically an auth bypass. And that's because of one function in particular, which is their login function. So the way they have this set up is, you know, servlets or whatever will call, they'll probably call into a check login function that ends up calling into this login function. And then if, you know, returns whatever information, that just lets, it's so the servlet can decide to override what the login thing does and doesn't necessarily force it, kind of like middleware would, or like a middleware setup where it just, you know, if this decides you're displaying the error, it displays the error. Slightly different structure there. But the problem comes down to the return values in login. So key problem on this, you've got the login function. It does pretty normal things here for the most part, or entirely, I guess. You've got the login, it's pulling out the username, password, whatever, like things you expect. Also supports the token base instead of a password, but, you know, pulls it out of the get, does whatever work. And ultimately the return values of this is usually going to be an error string. It's just going to, like, literally be the string error as the return if there was an error. And so what you see a lot of code doing, such as the check login, is when it's looking for an issue, if there was an issue during the login process, it goes, you know, if the string error is equal to whatever login gives you back. And so the issue is that login actually will return one other error case, and that is this require password change. If it detects that, you know, the parameter require password change is Y, it's going to return this other kind of third value. It's either expecting, actually, if you look at the documentation here, it returns a Boolean, which specifies whether or not the calling servlet should generate its own content. This loves to overwrite what I was talking about there. But what it actually returns is it can also end up returning error or require password change in addition to its normal success route, which, you know, is kind of an issue, at least logically. Like, the adding in this random third case is a little bit weird.
And that feels, you like, see this where the return value is being, like, repurposed like this, it just screams that there's a potential problem. Yeah,
absolutely. Like, when you see one, it's unexpected. Like, you expect, you know, the return value, one, it's documented as a Boolean, but you expect, like, okay, if they're using, like, the keywords, fine, they can keep that practice. But needs password change is not a, like, intuitive return value there. Like, it feels like somebody needed to write the, like, enforcing a password change and just kind of hacked it into the system in this way. and didn't necessarily consider how everything else needs to change because of this change. That's kind of what it feels like to me. I don't know what the commit history was there to actually say, like, oh yeah, it was introduced separately or whatever. Either way, like, it has that third return value. So when you get into this check login, it does some other, like, checks on the parameters, but then it ultimately does that error equals login, and that is going to return, you know, this, or it's then, sorry, it's not going to return. This is doing the check on the error value, so it's, you know, is the return value error or not? If the return value is the needs password change thing, or requires password change, it's not going to fall into any of this stuff. It's not going to remove the attribute login past. It's not going to do any of these things, and it's just going to, and it's not going to return error and check login. It's just going to continue on and do the default return, basically letting you skip authentication if you can get that one case to come up. And so the original post by Sonic will actually walk through their two test cases. Ultimately, they end up with the same thing. In one test case, very early on, if you have an empty username and password, it'll just detect that's empty, and so it'll fall into the case where checks, is the error list empty? If it is empty, then it will possibly return the require password change field. But when it comes to having a username or password in there, it just happens later. There's another spot where, well, there's several spots where the check happens, but if you provide usernames, it just happens a bit later where it returns with this. Ultimately, you make the request, you include this requires password change equals Y parameter, and you bypass auth. So pretty simple issue in that sense, but the way it kind of happens, you know, if I were reading the code and looking for issues, it's that third return value, that kind of unique, unexpected return value that stands out to me as being a code smell to look for issues. And, you know, would kind of be, I think, the thing that would catch my eye.
It was especially surprising to me that this wasn't caught with testing, though. Like, just being aware that that require password change parameter exists and just passing that in, like, you would think that would be a pretty easy test case to run if you were doing, like, any testing of the code. So it's pretty surprising in that aspect that it wasn't caught.
So this is more of a, like, developers will often write tests in the positive case. They're writing code. It hits, like, and they know this code exists. And so they'll write code that tries to hit that case where it's going to return that password change, but they're going to be writing it thinking about the password, when the password change is actually needed, like in the success case, it's going to do this. They're not necessarily going to be like, what happens if I include this random parameter in with all of my requests? Like, that isn't really a normal test case.
I guess.
They're going to have the context for it. So I could understand why somebody wouldn't necessarily test for that specifically. Like, it does have that impact because check logging gets used so widely, but it's not necessarily in the mind of the developer that this could be used on every page. They're going to be thinking about the pages and the flow that they intend to use it on and write it that way. At least when I was, you know, doing some dev work, that would kind of be my bias when it came to writing tests. And I imagine with others, like, you're kind of biased by writing the case that you know about and you're thinking about.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of test case could be biased out easily. Like, I won't deny that. But it's like in a login functionality, like, if there is a functionality you're going to try to, like, extensively test, you would think it would be that, you know. But
yeah, but yeah, like, so I could understand why somebody wouldn't necessarily be thinking about it.
Yeah, that design paradigm of having a return value acting like multifunctionally like that is just, yeah, like I said, it is something that indicates there's probably a problem there.
So I'll actually comment on that and say it's less of a worry to me or less of a standout or code smell to me when the return is supposed to be an enumerated value. Like, if the code is written from the beginning with that in mind, where it's like, yeah, we've got all these different cases, we're going to return the case. Like, when the code is already written where they're thinking about multiple returns, it's less of an issue versus this case where requires password changes feels like it's not the normal, it's not the proper sort of return value. Like, it feels hacked on. Like, that's kind of where I draw a distinction. I wouldn't necessarily see it as an issue just because there's multiple return values, but you kind of need that gain, especially because the documentation is a Boolean value, whereas that is clearly not a Boolean value.
I would say in general, though, it's probably a good idea to try to avoid designing your code like this to have multifunctional return values. Like, I think if you're trying to output something, like, if you're trying to have a password auth where it's Boolean and also support this password change, I would have that be done through, like, a parameter or something. Yes, I wouldn't, like, try to have the return value do that. Like, that's just asking for problems, right?
Yeah,
like,
and I think agree
trying
with you.
To keep your values Boolean or, like, an integer or something and not, like, an enumerable type is just a good idea in general.
So I agree with you on the point of, like, it stands out here, having that other value and not just being the distinct of either or. It's just, like, you know, you are going to have functions that return multiple values, and that's okay. Because I think of, like, any time you'd call, like, just a type function, like, what type is this? You're going to get the multi-values. But it doesn't stand out to me as an issue at that point.
Well, yeah, because it's very clear that that's what the intent of the function is. Exactly. Whereas with a check login, you're expecting either a success or a not. Like, yeah, it depends on what the intuition would lead to.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That intent is kind of what I was getting at. Like, code that's written where the intent is having multiple values in the response, like, where people writing it and using it are thinking about the fact that, yes, there are multiple values, is where I don't worry about it. It's the cases like this where it's not intuitive.
All right, so getting into another account takeover type issue, we have a GitLab post. So it's been a little while since we've covered some GitLab bugs, but this one is fairly interesting. It's one of those tweetable POCs. I think that's where I'd first seen it, was through a Twitter post. But yeah, I'll let Z get into it.
Yeah, and this one was fun. When I first saw it, I kind of just started digging into it. So it turns out they wait about 30 days before actually disclosing the issues themselves after it's patched. So we didn't actually have a lot of information. It's just, you know, account takeover via password reset without user interaction. Sounds pretty serious. And so started looking into it. I went and tried to find the actual commit that would fix it to see if I could learn anything. And just pulling that up now. I've got the commit here. It actually isn't that helpful, but it does kind of give you a place to start. The main patch that happened with this is password reset went from having this to where it would add in the email when you call send password reset instructions to just removing that. So the new definition of it doesn't take any options and doesn't provide any options. So that's the major change there, but it doesn't really tell you what the issue is, just that they're no longer trusting an email. And so if we actually take a look at this file, the email in this file itself isn't super clear where it's coming from, just from attributes, but ultimately that is just like attacker provided information coming through there. But that's kind of more getting into the framework and how things happen around there. So I won't bother with that, but attacker controlled values looks up this recoverable using this by email with errors. And then that recoverable is what's calling the send reset password instructions on. And if I was looking at the older code, this would be, I would have the to email. Actually, I should have pulled up the older code instead of this. There we go. So yeah, you can see grabs the email out of the attributes by email with errors, passes it or does the lookup here for this recoverable object. And then exactly what I was saying there, by email with errors ends up calling this find by any email, which kind of have to look a little bit or through a bit more code. To actually find where that is, but that exists in the like model for users. So presumably by email with theirs is also doing like a lookup for the user's record, finds any email, and either if there is no record, then you get the error, but otherwise it's returning the record that was found. And if we take a look, find by any email, just again takes in an email and ends up calling this by an email. So you're jumping through a bunch of functions here. Fortunately, it's close by an email. And this was the first thing that kind of ticked me off to maybe what the issue was. So I'll admit, I didn't even read the full report before I started jumping into the code. I'm just like, oh, auth bypass. Oh, they're not sharing the issue. So I didn't think they'd shared much information about how it worked. And I could have saved myself some time looking for more information. but I didn't. And so as I was looking at their code, I'm like, oh, okay, something like this, because suddenly this function here and everything up here, it's, you know, find by any email. It's, you know, the parameter there's email. And up above, you know, it's pulling out an email parameter from the attributes and all of that. And then all of a sudden we hit by any email and it has emails with plural form. And that was the first kind of key of what's going on here. And that's because emails can be either a string or an array of strings. And so you start getting an intuition about what's going on here. And that is, if you were to pass back on the first bit here, if you were to pass in for this email value, if you were to pass in an array of emails, then it's going to go and do this lookup by email with errors. It's going to lead into using this function, which accepts multiple. It's going to ultimately lead into this by any email call, which accepts an array and will look up users by all of the emails there and find the right record. But the code itself is going to continue to pass in this email array as where the password should be sent to. So if you have an array of users and actually reflects like the valid account that you want to have the password reset for, you would provide that as your first email, and then the second email in the array or further emails in the array would be your attacker emails. And thus you get to the POC where to the appropriate endpoint, you just send like an array of your valid email and then the attacker email as the second one there. And it'll send the email to both, or it will send the password reset email to both because it's expecting a string to be sent in, but it accepts an array being sent, which is, it feels like a very classic PHP issue to me. But just in general with scripting languages, we've seen similar issues with JavaScript, obviously here with Ruby, PHP, I mentioned already, like a lot of these just dynamically typed. Yeah, the dynamically typed languages where you can send an array and get some unexpected results because a lot of functions implicitly support arrays without necessarily intending to be used with arrays. So as long as those types aren't getting checked or you're not, you know, doing any sort of casting or something like that on the values, you can kind of get things slipping through like this. So it's a really fun bug. It is the sort of bug that, you know, other applications have similar issues. I'm okay with kind of talking about on the podcast. I mentioned how GitLab doesn't usually disclose the issues for like 30 days or whatever afterwards. However, as you can see, there is a tweet here with the POC. So I don't feel like I'm really ruining anything by walking through some of the code here. Since I was mentioning though, like I could have figured this out maybe earlier, just because they mentioned were any accounts actually compromised due to this vulnerability and how you can detect it. And one is looking at the production_json log file for, requests to user's password with email consisting of a JSON array with multiple email addresses. So that kind of gives it away, but I enjoyed looking at the code and that was the first thing I jumped to. But it's easier if you read before diving in.
I have that problem too. It's so easy to skip over sentences, especially in advisories where you're reading through a lot of like, I don't know what the right term is. I want to say like copy paste text where you see the same sort of text on a lot of different advisories. It's easy to just treat it as noise and not actually read everything. So I fall into that trap sometimes too. But again, one of those issues that could have been avoided by just keeping the functionality simple and not allowing these like polymorphic returns or arguments or whatever, like, it's got kind of the same issue that the first post had, just instead of being on the return, it's on the parameter. So.
Yeah, in this case, it's like checking your value types when you're doing your like sanitization enforcement. Checking the actual type, make sure it's a string versus an array. But you're kind of just falling into this because the language supports it. The language doesn't offer.
Well, like they do acknowledge in the comment that the fact that it could be these two different types, like they know it's a behavior.
It's a behavior of that deeper function. But if you take a look at the actual code written here for the recoverable by any email, like this thing's just calling like by email with errors. And then that's calling find by any email. And I know, find by any email.
If they had separated this into two different functions for the array and the string, this problem would have been avoided entirely instead of just supporting both of them in one function.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, that's what I was getting at there.
Okay. And I think I misunderstood you then.
Yeah, no worries.
Because, like, yeah, it's documented that does that, but nobody's, well, I'm sure people are, but
basically,
you know, like, that code isn't calling the one that does both, is what I'm getting at. Like, the functions that it's using really seem like they're, you know, find a user by their primary email, or, you know, confirm, like, the any aspect of this is more that it's going to look up the account, including, like, confirmed and secondary emails, not primary. It's not clear it supports multiple until you get pretty deep in the code. That's where I thought you were getting at it, where I just didn't think it was obvious that it did support that.
Basically, what I was getting at, though, was, like, obviously hindsight 2020, all that. But if I was in the dev's position and I was, like, writing this comment, I would have stopped writing this comment and been like, we need to change this design a little bit because this is dumb. This is dumb supporting an array and a string in the same function. That these should be two different functions. That way, anything that calls it is aware of what they're actually providing and what the implications of that are.
Yeah, so, although this is a pretty, so for all of that, like, this is a common pattern and also a common source of vulnerability, so keep that in mind when you're looking. But it is a common pattern that you'll see where you'll have, like, this one function that accepts all sorts of different parameters and then figures things out from there, rather than doing what you're saying pattern, where you know, have, like, your authoritative function that I would say, like, in this case, if you had the by any email, it should, or, like, the root function should just take the array. And if you want to call it as a singular email address, that will call, you call that function that then calls by an email with an array of the input value. And that way, you know, if you have an array, it's going to be an array inside of an array and should be caught because it's not the right types. Like, doing that, because you still benefit from wanting that authoritative function. Like, you don't want to duplicate functionality across, like, basically the same code across multiple functions, but
I would argue separate that's better than this, to be honest. Sacrificing a bit of, like, duplicated code for...
This happens a lot, though. Like, that's a lot of duplicated code. Because there's a lot of times where you just might want to provide more than one, and you might just want one. Like, there's a lot of things where that happens, so...
At the very least, there should be a parameter that distinguishes between them, like, you know, a Boolean that's, like, multiple values or single value. Something like that. Like, it should just... Basically, it should be more clear at the API level if it's treating as a single or a multiple. And the way it's being done here, like, by any email... I mean, the email's parameter... you said kind of shout it out to you, but, like, when people are calling that, they're not necessarily going to see that. So,
well, the thing is, yeah, like, to be clear, most, I don't think a lot of code is calling by an email. It would be calling find by an email or something like that. Like, it would be using this.
There is that additional layer of abstraction. Yeah.
Like, that's like, I could be wrong. I didn't look at the code on that. Although I will say, I really hate the idea of using a Boolean flag to, like, change the functionality. Like, that is a sign that you need two functions. But that's why I said, like, if you had a function that translated it into the array, like, one function that just takes the input as a singular thing and converts it into an array and calls the authoritative one, that's more the pattern I want to see. But like I said, this is a super common pattern. People do it all the time. It's just a common need, and it's very nice in these scripting languages because it enables you to just, like, write this code once, basically. It's pretty nice, but creates these sorts of issues. So you at least have to be aware of it.
All right, so getting into our last topic, by Secure Layer 7, we have an unauthenticated RCE in Adobe Cold Fusion, which is used for deploying web apps. It's been around for a very long time. A little bit before the show, Z was talking about the fact that he probably hasn't seen Cold Fusion in, like, how many years or whatever it was.
Cold Fusion, I mean, it was never, like, super popular. Yeah, I mean, I looked into Cold Fusion briefly when I was, like, in my early teens. As, like, oh, maybe I should learn this instead of whatever. And it's like, nope, I'm going to go some other route, but... I looked at it, and that's about the last time I've needed to care about it.
Yeah, so it's interesting seeing it in this episode. I don't know if we've talked about it on the podcast before. I don't remember.
I think we've talked about it once. because I do actually recall a topic where it's come up, but
after the episode, I'm gonna have to look at when we would have talked about it, because it's must have been a long time.
Yeah, I'll see if I can find it while you're describing.
Okay, so yeah, but long story short, it's used for like deploying and quickly spinning up web applications. And this chain of vulns, or singular vuln, however you want to classify it, we'll get into that, was confirmed to have been used in the wild, attributed to a Chinese government-sponsored APT against Hong Kong and the US. So it includes two vulnerabilities, or one, again, depending on how you read it, and because they both kind of leverage the same thing. And that's the fact that there's this class name parameter that can be passed into a request. And if that class name, if it doesn't match like a valid ColdFusion class, it'll treat that class name as a path and uses that to compile the file on the fly for rendering the page. So if you specify a class name of etc/password, for example, or like pass reverse into etc/password, it'll read its file contents, treat it as a ColdFusion template, and render using that file, which is pretty much the first like attack that they talk about, which is like this arbitrary file read. So you just send the class name, ./... etc. /etc/password, and it would render that in the response. The second bug, or second attack, I should say, abuses a similar thing with the class name parameter being used to get the file rendered, but it uses a different request first. And that's like a log injection type issue through the variables parameter. So bring up the relevant request. They have this curl command, submits it to the cfide error conflict.csc endpoint with a test method. And with this test method, they can pass in a cf execute tag, which just takes like a program and the name parameter of that tag and allows that to be executed through ColdFusion. And this variable's parameter gets reflected in the log file. So by doing this request, they can get the cf execute tag put into a log file, and then using the same sort of request as earlier, where they set the class name, instead of setting it to etc/password, they set it to the log file, so .../logs coldfusionout.log, and that cf execute tag will get parsed and executed when it goes to compile on the fly for rendering that page. So pretty cool with that log injection aspect. We don't get to see that too often, especially in this way. And as the title says, like, it's unauthorized, so it is pretty impactful, and it's not too surprising that an APT would have been taking advantage of this, because, yeah, that's a pretty wild code execution primitive to have. So,
it's definitely a fun flow. Like, it reminds me of the old, like, LFI to RC techniques, where you would do very similar, but with PHP, and then if you had a local file include, you'd include, like, the log file back in there or something else. And I will mention, if you're seeing that like CFX here, why does that matter? Like, ColdFusion has these tags as like part of its language. It's almost HTML like in that, where you write a lot of stuff using these various tags as your function calls. And so this is proper like ColdFusion code that's injected in there.
And actually, on the APT aspect, jumping back to our first topic, I meant to bring this up then, I just kind of forgot about it. The Sonic Wall vulnerability was also exploited in the wild. They said that they saw a large number of exploitation attempts on that. So yeah, two of the three topics we've had today have had in the wild exploitation. So it's kind of funny.
And for what it's worth, I could not find the episode that we talked about ColdFusion. So maybe we didn't, and I'm just misremembering, but nowhere in my notes do I mention ColdFusion. So
okay. Yeah. I didn't remember talking about it, so that makes sense. But yeah, I mean, the vulnerability is pretty simple. It's just the fact that class name parameter, you can just pass in an arbitrary path and have that compile this ColdFusion code. It's really just that simple.
Yeah, like this is just insecure. I don't think
they talk about how they fix this. I'm guessing they just don't respect like that class name parameter anymore, or they have it heavily restricted.
Yeah, I'm not sure if they would, just try and prevent, like, lock down that class name a bit more tightly rather than being arbitrary files, like having either a limited directory or something could be a fix. But yeah, I don't think they talk about the patch.
Yeah, I'm just taking a look at the CISA advisory to see if maybe the patch would have been mentioned there really quick. Yeah, I don't see anything on the patch. Okay, oh well. But yeah, I'm guessing it's just, like, mitigating that class name vector, and either not allowing it to be pat like attacker controlled or just heavily restricting it. So
yeah, like honestly, it feels like a very insecure function to even have in the first place.
Very insecure design. Yeah, that's why I was kind of curious on how they would have patched it, but I can't find that information. So
maybe they just removed XML RPC.
Maybe. But yeah, overall, like we don't have a ton of vulnerabilities today, but the ones we did have, they do have some cool unique aspects to them. Like they're not some of the more common bugs that you see. They are more logical issues, like design type issues. So
yeah, which I mean are bugs to keep an eye out for. They're the fun bugs in my opinion.
For sure.
Although I guess there are some very technical bugs that are fun too. I won't say nothing else is fun, but I like these ones. I thought this is a good set.
Yeah, me too. All right, so that's all the core topics that we have. We do have a few shout-outs, which I'll let Z get into, and then we'll wrap up the show.
Yeah, a couple quick shout-outs. Do have one other bug here, kind of, which is no new iPhone, no secure iOS. Looking at an unfixed iOS vulnerability. Because this one is a bug that probably not just going to run across outside of like testing for these sorts of browser issues, I wasn't super concerned about treating this as like a full topic, but the core idea, and you can get a little bit more about how it worked, but you'd create like a page with a SVG on it, and you could basically trick the SVG into running another file. So they have this XSL copy of, and then you know, Slack document exploit.php, and then your exploit.php file includes more XML that, in a way, like what you do with maybe entity injection, you would do almost like a client side entity injection in order to get it to read the like Etsy password file, Etsy host, Etsy groups, read some sensitive files, get to do that and just reflect it into the HTML page. And thus you can exfil it from there, or it's basically dumped the user, but this is kind of happening on the client side and since doing it to yourself. So it's a little bit different than your standard like XML entity stuff, but I don't know. I thought it was worth a quick read if you're interested in that area, but you know, it's not really a test case that you can apply to a lot of other areas. And the other shout out I had was this advertisement for BitHawk security. I don't care too much about the product, never used that, don't have any comments about it, but they're talking about how we made $120,000 in bug bounty with automation. And I always have a little bit of interest in just seeing what type of automation setup people do have and what they're doing with their automation and what kind of they chose to focus on. They're talking about how they're scanning like 2.5 million hosts a day, which sounds pretty impressive to me. I don't know what people are doing for their automation bug bounty. So it always seems like there's just these massive numbers. Because it feels like if you're going for automation, scale is going to be a big part of that and having like a very wide scale. They talk about some of the details about what they're scanning for. Nothing too surprising here. It's a lot of things that are going to be easy to scan for, just doing it at scale. And talk like their most common vulnerabilities, some of their most reported things like 37 XSS and Swagger UI, and you know, having a few Log4Shell vulnerabilities there, their highest pay. There's just a little bit of interesting information about their setup, and they have their conclusions. I was going to call out, which was, one they call is consistency is key. You know, companies make the same mistake over and over. Collaboration for the win, and quality of reports matter. So actually having a good report, I think any of you who have sent in reports probably understand quality does make a big impact. And some of the things that they did right, which was engine optimization from day one. And I will say, I'm not entirely sure if I agree with them on like that being super important. So with bug bounty automation, scale matters. So I was just talking about. But you don't necessarily want to spend, you know, a month of time optimizing it when you could at least be scanning something while you optimize, or like, you know, being blocked by that optimization. So it's at least something to think of. Common saying in the development world is optimization is the root of all evil. Premature. missed part of that. Premature optimization is the root of all evil. It is a very important part of that. Doing that before you necessarily need to, but you know, focusing on the quality. This is the second thing they say they did right, was focusing on quality of the vulnerability rather than amount of modules used for scanning. So, you know, being selective about what they do, because I mean that every test you run is going to take time. So trying to optimize on that can make sense. And then the last one there, I'm not sure is really applicable generally. Keep everything in one place, talking about having like their bug backlog, module depths, all that. That's most of you probably aren't going to be running as like a main service for other people. But yeah, I thought it was at least an interesting post. Like I said, I'm not necessarily, you know, saying anything about the tool because I've not used it, don't know anything about it. But I like seeing what people are doing with automation because that is an area that I haven't really done much with. But it's nice to see the information about what they're doing. So,
yeah. And it is an important approach. Like, you know, it might be boring in some aspects where it's like, oh, it's already known issues. You're not finding new stuff. Like, it known issues has a high impact across the board. So
it's not finding your own issues. It's not that. It's, you know, I maybe prefer getting in there with the manual assessment and manual testing, but it is also important that people are actually doing this sort of scanning because it keeps everybody safer when these easy bugs are being found and are being done. So if you want to spend more time on the development side of things, it makes sense to go and like, this is a development thing where good development skills can pay off with, you know, better automation.
Yeah.
And like more effective automation. Yeah. That's the last shout out.
Yep. That's all the topics we have. So as always, thanks goes out to everyone who tuned in. Previous episodes can be found on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcast. You can join our community by joining our Discord and Twitter. Links for those are down below in the description. And with that said, we'll see you in the next one.